You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Judy Wicks about the idea of a peace economy, how the war economy maintains injustice, and how we can all start to take action to change it.
Right now, our global economy, where we buy things from all over the world, is protected. This way of doing business is protected with the military. And our corporations are basically mandated to continue to grow larger and larger, and therefore constantly seeking new markets, new sources of natural resources, and new sources of cheap labor. And so when we buy from large corporations and goods that are shipped from all over the place, we're adding to an economy that necessitates a military to protect corporate access to these three things, you know, markets, natural resources, and cheap labor. The more we engage in international trade, the more likely there is going to be conflict around that, where if ultimately every community had local food, water, energy security, that there'd be much less reason, if any, for warfare.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio, Agwanu, Golazikawoba. Welcome and greetings to you in my native language. I'm coming to you from my home in the Don Land in Bunawabskig territory, in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. This morning I looked out over the waters of the Penobscot River and saw the light sparkling and being reflected off the water, and it reminded me of the work that we do on this show, which is to reflect the light back to all of you. And speaking of light, I'm joined by my illuminating co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Sherry, it's always a pleasure to occupy the airwaves and to go out into our friends and neighbors and fellow countrymen and women and bring some of the good ideas that we have heard through our rather unusual grapevines into circles that haven't heard them yet. This week we're going to talk with Judy Wicks, who wrote a very wonderful piece about the peace economy in Alternate. And in addition to doing a series of articles about this, which we'll talk about more later, she is also the author of a book called Good Morning, Beautiful Business. She is the founder of Philadelphia's White Dog Cafe, a pioneer in the farm-to-table movement, and a co-founder of the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. Judy has been a pioneer in sustainable and ethical businesses for a very long time, and she's a great guest to dig into this very intriguing word, the peace economy. Welcome to the show, Judy.
Thank you, Rivera and Sherry.
Judy, it's wonderful to have you with us today. We've actually had a number of shows where we're looking at the economy from various angles because we think it's really important to look at how we invest our time, our energy, our resources, and how that has framed the way that we engage one another as human beings. I'd love to start off the show today by having you tell our listeners, what is the peace economy?
Well, I believe that every time we spend a dollar, that we're ultimately affecting the life that we live, the world that we live in, and that that money can go towards building a peace economy or a war economy. And I think that one of the most important things is about spending our money in a way that is fair and just and as much as possible local. Right now, our global economy, where we buy things from all over the world, is protected. This way of doing business is protected with the military. And our corporations, our publicly traded corporations, are basically mandated to continue to grow larger and larger, and therefore constantly seeking new markets, new sources of natural resources, and new sources of cheap labor. And so when we buy from large corporations and goods that are shipped from all over the place, we're adding to an economy that necessitates a military to protect corporate access to these three things, you know, markets, natural resources, and cheap labor, where when we spend our money in a way that supports our local economy, that it's really shifting power away from large multinational corporations to locally based community businesses and a local economy. And I feel like a lot of people don't really think about that, and that we, and maybe don't even think about how a peace economy is possible. But I think as long as we're shipping things long distance around the world, the basic necessities that we need to live, food, shelter, clothing, energy, that we're depending on a military to protect these trade routes. The more we engage in international trade, the more likely there's going to be conflict around that, where if ultimately every community had local food, water, energy security, that there'd be much less reason, if any, for warfare.
I'm really glad that you articulated all that, Judy, because I think most of us, or many of us, when we think about the peace economy and conversely the military economy or the war economy, most of us are not running out to spend $1 billion on a fighter jet plane. We're not going down to the street corner to go buy a bomb, for example. So we don't see necessarily the first line of direct commerce that we might think about when we think about the military and a war economy. But what you're really bringing up is kind of a larger, more complex view of how the military and the economy have been entwined. And one of the things you wrote about in your article is the long history of this. On Love and Revolution Radio, we've actually spoken quite a bit with our listeners about conquest, colonization, and the kinds of dominations and exploitations that accompany that historically. And one of the things that people don't necessarily think about is that when we're talking about a global economy, that we've had a global economy for over 1,000 years, and arguably longer than that, that these trade routes that you speak of also go back historically and predate what we think of as the modern global economy, which is kind of like the old system on steroids. But what I'd like to ask you to articulate for our listeners is that historical legacy and how the military has actually supported the development of the capitalist economy. It's not just the capitalist economy. I don't like to just blame that, but there's a direct correlation between the need for conquest and colonization to amass capital to grow this capitalist economy that you were just articulating earlier in its modern day interpretation. So I'm wondering if you would give us a little historical footnote on where did this come from and where is it at now?
Well, I mean, I'm not a historian, but my general view of history is that the rise of colonialism was when we really began to build a global economy. And colonialism was really based on exploitation, you know, of indigenous populations, whether they were in Asia or Africa or Latin America, wherever, that the colonial powers exploited the population, the local population, taking their natural resources and oftentimes enslaving them, and to take these goodies home for their marketplace. So, you know, I think that this idea, this exploitive system is still practiced today. And, you know, it's disguised because you couldn't really call it colonialism anymore, but we call it economic development, where we claim that corporations going into a less developed country, who the argument is that they're providing jobs, and so people come off the farming life and move into the cities to take jobs in factories or whatever, and they're supposed to be better off. But in most cases, it's been shown that people aren't better off, that they were better off in their communities, in villages that are self-reliant in basic needs. I mean, Gandhi, I think, is probably the most, I believe that he was really the kind of the father of the modern local economy movement, because his tactic was to throw off British colonialism by simply not supporting it. He would say to the Indian people, you know, our weapon against colonialism is to be self-reliant. So grow your own vegetables and become self-reliant in food. Take those clothes that were manufactured in Great Britain and burn them all, because we here in India grow the cotton and so on. We can, and that's why you see them with a spinning wheel, we can make our own clothes instead of sending our cotton and flax to Europe to be made into clothing and then sent back here for us to buy. Let's make our own clothes. So he always wore the homespun clothing as a model of this. And so, you know, he was basically saying that local self-reliance is the key to freedom. That if we have control over our basic needs of food, water, clothing, energy, that we're no longer under the thumb of colonial powers. So he was a big influence on Schumacher, E.F. Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful, who took these concepts further in Western society. And now our contemporary local economy movement that I've been involved with for, I guess, like the last 15 years or so, is really built on this history of fighting authoritarian control by whether it's other governments or corporations, by local self-reliance, that we don't need to buy from these large corporations that are controlling our economy and causing great inequality and causing environmental issues as well. By working together, we can create economies that empower our own local community and make us self-reliant in our basic needs.
Judy, I think it's important to note also that self-reliance is also key to protecting our local ecosystems and, you know, building a sense of community and unity amongst all users within a given system. However, the system itself is prohibitive in that it's rolling rapidly and aggressively toward globalization. And it becomes prohibitive for individuals of lesser means to be able to jump into this system of localized living. In some ways, people look at that as being an elitist privilege to be able to buy all of your fruits and vegetables from the local farmers or farmers markets or, you know, local health food stores where the costs may be much greater than they are in the supermarket. And so how do people break into these localized economies in a way that honors where they may be at as individuals that may not have the means to be able to do these things? Oftentimes we look at it as a conscious choice and a moral high ground, when in fact the disparities that exist within the economy as it stands actually prevent people from entering into that system.
Right. I do see that as a big challenge. You know, and the way I see it, you have to start somewhere. So I'd say with the farm to table movement, a lot of it started with restaurants. And that's how I got into it, because I was in the restaurant business. And I saw that buying from local farmers, that there was great value in that. And I think that there was a lot of the local food movement did start with farm-to-table restaurants. And those are obviously patronized by upper-middle-class people. But what that's doing is lowering the cost of local food. Because as people who can afford it start the movement, they're building up a local food system and building up distribution systems and so on, so that the cost of buying local becomes competitive with the factory farming of fruits and vegetables and meats and so on that's then shipped into the community. So I think that the idea that local is more expensive, I think that in many places it still is, but in many places that's not true anymore, that the local system has developed to the point where it can compete price-wise, that what you buy at the farmer's market is close in price to what you get at the supermarket. And plus, there's now a lot of, through the farm bill, I mean, there's most of the things in the farm bill are negative as far as I'm concerned, but one of the good things about the farm bill is food stamps or SNAP, or, you know, there's a lot of different programs now that a federal as well as some local governments have that kind of level the playing field to some extent by giving low-income people access to more foods. And now they do take food stamps or SNAP, you know, at farmers markets and so on, so that I think it's more and more accessible in terms of food. You know, clothing is still like a real big issue, and it's not as far along, I think, as food in terms of a basic need that's being localized. And, you know, and there's a lot of reasons for that. At this point, I think clothing that's made locally is going to be more expensive than clothing that's made in sweatshops in Asia for many reasons, but mostly labor costs. And with energy, another important basic need, I mean, the sun is free. That's the logical place where we should get our energy. And I think one of the most important things we should be doing right now is making solar available to low-income people, because solar is economical. I mean, you just need the money to get it on your roof, you know, but once you have that, then your electric bills are greatly reduced. So if we could just get loans to low-income people, they don't even need grants. They need a loan to get the solar on the roof, and then they can repay that loan from the reduced electric bill. So it's a very economical thing to do. So it depends on where you're looking. I meant to say with clothing, that one of the things I've noticed with the young people, because I think the younger people in our society are much more attuned to a lot of these things, and it's become very fashionable to wear clothes from the thrift store. And I remember that back in the 60s as well. So, you know, you don't have to buy new clothing. That there's, you go to a thrift store and you can find some really, really well-made clothing that is very little wear and tear at all. And a lot of times I'll compliment somebody on their dress and they say, oh, I got it at the thrift store for $5 or something. So there's a lot of alternatives. I don't think that you need to be wealthy to participate in this localization movement.
I think it's been a really interesting field to observe and pay attention to. As many of our listeners know, I got my start in life on an organic farm in northern Maine, where we really were part of pushing forward the local food movement. And we have watched these dynamics of how do we, I guess, capitalize or bring financial resources into these areas like food and local agriculture that really need that reinvestment. And how do we also make sure that we are finding that sweet spot between economic justice for the consumer on one end, as in the people who don't have a lot of money, and for the farmers on the other side of that spectrum, who historically have been undervalued, underfunded, and not paid for their labor, which has created ripple effects of injustice in terms of mechanization, the use of laborers in the field who are treated poorly, the lack of any sort of parallel labor standards to what you might have in an office space. So there's layers upon layers of this. But one thing I'm happy to report that I've been noticing is that the movement for localism has actually taken a bit of a wake-up call. And certainly not in all areas, but in many areas, very creative people are pushing back against this very problem that Sherry has articulated. And one of the places I like to keep my eye on is Detroit. Because Detroit has not only grappled with economic justice, but also with the very notion of work, money, and exchange, and is, as a community, really radically turning that on its head in ways that are completely revolutionary. So I think it's an exciting time to keep paying attention to the dynamics around that question. I wanted to ask you, Judy, a question about a little bit further about energy security and this renewable energy spectrum, because that is one of the major points of a peace economy, in addition to the economic reasons why we can, as a society, prioritize getting local, and especially locally controlled, renewable energy infrastructure into low-income communities, not to mention all the other communities. Another whole element around it is that we have fought so many wars for oil. I mean, we've had all sorts of other reasons that we claim we're going to invade Kuwait, Iraq, Iran, all these places. But in reality, many of us know that several of those wars were fought pretty much for the oil. So can you articulate a little bit, or share a little bit with our listeners about that end of the peace economy and its connection to renewable energy?
Yeah, well, as you say, that's one of the main causes of war is access to oil. So it's a key point, really, in changing our economy is to disengage with gas and oil and to move towards renewable sources such as solar and wind. For me, for instance, this is something that's happened recently. I live in Pennsylvania, where fracking is a real issue in the rural areas, and both people who are in favor of it and people who are against it. But I went on a tour of the areas that are affected by fracking and talked to people whose lives have been destroyed by the fracking. Either it polluted their water or the noise of the 24-hour trucks going by their house day and night, you know, has driven them from their homes. It's just heartbreaking stories about how fracking has affected their lives. And so, you know, I'm thinking to myself, well, I use natural gas. And so I'm complicit in the harm that's being done to them. And so I decided that I was going to get rid of natural gas. So I went through a whole process of switching out my water heater to electric, my furnace to electric, and my stovetop. That was the thing I didn't want to give up the most was cooking on gas, because cooking on gas is so much better than cooking on electric. But then I discovered something called induction stovetops, which work, they're electric powered, but they work with magnets. So they heat the pan. If you're using an iron-based pan, like a cast iron or whatever, it makes the molecules in the iron move around. That heats the pan, but it doesn't heat the stove. So there's no lost energy. So they're very, very efficient. But anyway, to make a long story short, I transitioned all this equipment and then called up the gas company and said, turn off my gas. And so I now, and I also put solar on my roof. So I have a totally renewable electric run house. My total power bill for the last 3 months has been around $17 because I don't have no gas bill. And that's what my electric bill is during a time when the sun is high during the summer and I don't use air conditioning. I have my house set up in a way where I have a lot of breeze going through and fans and whatnot and windows and I don't have walls. It's just very open. So I don't, even though I live in Philadelphia, I don't use air conditioning. So anyway, I'm just giving this as an example of how it is possible to get off of oil and gas, that we just have to be conscious of it. And right now I'm in the process of buying an electric car that will be powered from my house, which is mainly solar, but also what I do draw down from the grid is renewable. And that's another kind of low-hanging fruit that in most places people can sign up with their electric provider for 100% renewable, solar, wind, or whatever. And I did that about 15 years ago and continue to do that, of course, now. So that combination between my own solar-produced electricity and the renewable electricity I buy from the grid and the lack of oil allows me to be off of oil and gas. So these things are very doable, and yet we just don't really think about it. And I guess the thing that gets to me, and that's what got to me about the gas, is that it's low-income people that are most hurt by climate change and by the extraction of, and transportation and use of fossil fuels. I was sitting there the other day by the river in Philadelphia watching these oil trains go by. They're transporting oil from the tar sands, you know, down to be refined and so on. And I think this is just insanity. First, they're ruining the communities where the indigenous communities in Canada, where there's tar sand. Then they have these trains that are very dangerous with highly explosive materials going through towns and whatnot that occasionally blow up. And then they take them places to burn where the carbon dioxide is harmful to the environment, hurts everybody. But those who get hurt the most are low-income people. Either they're at the site where it's being exploited, or they're next to refineries and having to breathe this stuff. In Philadelphia, the people that live near refineries, like everywhere else, are low-income people. So my cleaning lady, for instance, her son has asthma, and she lives near the refineries, but she doesn't have the money to move from there. The whole system is just set up in a way that allows the corporate polluters to get away with breaking the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act or any of them and causing great harm. But it's always to low-income people, you know, the people in New Orleans or the fisher people that live along the shores where the sea is rising and so on. And it's this great injustice that really maddens me. And so that's one of the reasons that, you know, I made this move with get off of natural gas. So anyway, that oil is really the lifeblood of corporate globalization. And you couldn't even have a global economy without oil to ship things all over the world. But basically, what's the greatest challenge we have today is climate change. I mean, that could possibly end civilization. And, you know, it just pains me that people are not right now doing everything possible to get off fossil fuels and to create a renewable energy system. It's just so clear that that's what has to be done, you know. But the oil and gas companies have so much power over the media and over our lives in general that we don't seem to be making a dent in this. And that there should be a whole national, just like when World War II, where all the industry was turned towards producing war bombs and planes and whatnot, tanks for the war, we should be doing the same thing now with turning industry towards producing wind turbines and solar panels. And this should be the race. We did it with the war, but why can't we do it to address climate change? So needed right now.
Judy, have to challenge you on a couple of things, because I think that our listeners are certainly going to pick up on this.
Okay.
You know, to maybe think about, because I'm sure that you're aware of these things and that it's just, as you're talking about them, maybe you're not thinking about the language. So when we're talking about economic disparity, and we're talking about great disparity within income levels within our society, and you're talking about having solar panels on your house, and the ability to have solar panels is easy for people without a grant, or, you know, they can just get a loan. Not everybody can just get a loan. And,
No. We have to have programs that do this.
Right.
We have to have programs that do this.
Right. But even with programs, it would be difficult for some members of the society to be able to do that. And so I think that people are going to just pick up some kind of disconnect that I want to bring into the light so that we can address it now, so that people aren't just tuning out. Being someone that's grown up very, very poor and having struggled as a very young mother and a single mother for the majority of my children's lives, there were days when I could barely feed my children and feed myself at the same time. And so just being careful of the language, things like that, that kind of disconnect you from the reality of people like that. And when you're talking about, you know, your housekeeper, those things might disconnect you in the minds of some of our listeners. And I want to address that because I know that you're aware of the connection that needs to be made between the poorest among us and those people who just think, hey, it was really easy for me. There's no problem. You can just do this. I'm an attorney. I volunteer a majority of my time, which means I make just enough money to pay my bills. I'm not in a position right now where I could put solar panels on my house. And so there is a division there that needs to be addressed. There is a discrepancy there that needs to be addressed. So I just want to bring that in so maybe we can think about that as we go forward in the way that we talk about some of these issues.
Sure. I want to go back to the point of putting solar on one's roof. I do feel that, just as was the case in the food movement, that those who are in an economic position to go first should do so. It's our responsibility, I feel, to do that. That if we have the money to support local farmers, or we have the money to put solar on a roof, that it's our obligation to do what's best for the common good. And so when I talk about this, I'm often talking to try and inspire people who can't afford it to do so. But I think the point, you know, that I'd also like to make is that things that are practices that are environmentally sustainable are also financially sustainable, that solar energy is, in fact, cheaper than gas and oil. And so if we can, right now I'm doing this solarized program in Center City. Center City, Philadelphia, is a well-to-do community. So I'm trying to get those people who live in that community to do the right thing and put solar on the roofs. And then they will see their electric bill be in half what they were paying. It pays itself back in 7 months. So then what I'm hoping to do is to ask those same people if they are willing to help others put solar on their roof. Sort of like when you're on an airplane and you put the oxygen on your mask on your own face first, and then you help another. It's the same kind of idea.
Let me just ask you a question in there. And so when I think about that and think about having individuals who do have the means to be able to do this, to have their bills reduced, it sounds a lot like the system that we have right now, where those who have the means actually are getting the benefits. And then what happens to those lower end users who can't afford to do that? Their rates go up because of the exit of those other parties from the market. And so it's a really complex issue. And I think that we need to be able to talk about it if we want to talk about it in regards to not only equality, but equanimity. We need to be really honest about what the implications of that are.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. Conversation today with Judy Wicks about the peace economy, Judy draws on her experience working with business people, entrepreneurs, and investors to speak about the ways in which those who have a lot of financial resources should leverage those in support of a more just, sustainable, equitable peace economy. So in this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to balance that part of the conversation with a few notes on how those of us, myself included, who don't have a lot of financial resources, can also work for economic justice and greater peace. Code Pink's Building a Local Peace Economy project page contains the following insightful quote about what is a peace economy and why it's important. They write, "We live at a time where the economic power is concentrated in the hands of the wealthy, who control the political, social, and economic systems to safeguard and expand their power. Even though there is evidence to show that humans are predisposed to be cooperative and sharing, the war economy survives by creating the experience of scarcity that forces the reliance on greed, selfishness, competition, and a sense that we are separate. We need to build systems based on sharing rather than competing for the world's resources and labor." The Code Pink page also quotes E.F. Schumacher, author of Small is Beautiful. The quote says, "People who live in highly self-sufficient local communities are less likely to get involved in large-scale violence than people whose existence depends on worldwide systems of trade." I don't know about you listeners, but I grew up working poor in a small farming community in rural Maine. Self-sufficiency was a way of life and of economic survival. Community self-sufficiency and sharing are qualities that those of us on the lower end of the income and wealth spectrum have created and maintained in order to survive the many economic challenges that have swept the globe. We found lots of inventive and creative ways to leverage non-financial forms of wealth, such as our creativity, ingenuity, material resources, time, connections and social networks, our cultures, and more. Some of these ways include cooperatives, buying clubs, childcare swaps, tool co-ops, libraries for books, and toy libraries, sharing our resources with one another, walking across the street to borrow a pinch of salt or a cup of sugar, thrift stores, yard sales, recycled goods, swap meets, time banks, barter, trade, clothing exchanges, mentorship, apprenticeship, providing and sharing housing, housing cooperatives, renting with roommates, cooperative agriculture, worker co-ops, community-wide harvest gathering, building, or community improvement projects, free boxes, free stores, carpools, rideshares, public and mass transit, buying clubs, common space systems, community credit unions, work parties, volunteer efforts, faith-based services and resource sharing, and much more. As you can see, there's almost no end to the creative and inventive ways that people without a lot of financial resources have created systems that help meet the needs of our communities. In the historic shift from community-oriented living to individualized, atomized consumer culture, millions of people, both domestically and globally, lost touch with some of these resources as we shifted to modernized notions of ownership and autonomy, in which every family was expected to have a house, car, lawnmower, refrigerator, television, washer-dryer, weed whacker, and so on. This was very good for business, and not so good for us. When the economy goes downhill and people lose financial resources, this shift to individualization often means that the networks, social ties, and non-monetary forms of resource sharing are no longer available to people. The good news is we can revitalize them. The even better news is that hundreds of thousands of your fellow citizens are already working on doing this. As we work toward creating a more just, equitable, sustainable, and peaceful economy, we need to keep in mind that economic justice requires work on all levels. We need those who hold shares, stocks, and investments to divest and reinvest. We need major wealth holders to disperse their concentrated wealth in ways that build more equality and justice. We need politicians to get their acts together and pass legislation and tax reform. We need employers to pay living wages and benefits. Landlords need to lower their rents. Public office holders need to invest our public dollars in programs that create better social services for the public, not just for businesses or wealthy individuals. And realistically, we need to be organizing nonviolent movements for change to achieve any of those previously mentioned goals. Nonviolent action is required, And as frequent listeners to Love and Revolution Radio know, that means using both hands of nonviolence, the hand that opposes injustice and the hand that proposes solutions. For hundreds of years, people around the world have used organized collective action to wage struggle for economic justice. Within the context of the shift to the peace economy, we know we're going to need to see everything from sit-ins at your local energy utility to blockades of pipelines to organizing buying cooperatives and lending circles. We'll need to make buying local a thing we do to support each other rather than the mega corporations. As Sherry has brought up on the show, we understand that rock in a hard spot feeling that comes with strapped finances. We can't always use our buying power, but we can always use our people power. We can organize boycotts, partial boycotts, protests, demonstrations, strikes, and walkouts to demand living wages. We can use mutual aid like the labor movements who came before us. We could take back our dollars wherever we can, whenever we can, in ways both small and large. And more than just taking back our pocket change, we can organize to insist that the fruits of the labor of our whole community are returned to benefit our whole community. Building a locally based sustainable peace economy that can resist the militarized domination of the transnational megacorporations and the economic elites requires that we take action in as many ways as possible. Every person in the 100% has experiences to offer towards this effort. We may have different ways by which we take action, but rich and poor alike both have a lot of ways to contribute to making this change. If you have ideas about how you and others can participate in working for economic justice, share them with us. You can send us an email via the Love and Revolution radio page on my website, www.riverasun.com. Thank you for spending this time with us during our Nonviolence Minute. This week's featured music is Pose Tismains by Moutin. You can find it on SoundCloud. And now let's return to speaking with Judy Wicks.
We also need to be really honest that there's a big move going on right now to actually outlaw those activities, where there are restrictions now being placed on solar power in a number of places around the country. There's a restriction on people being able to grow food and share it from their own backyard. And so, you know, the system is actually moving with us as we move. And so when we start talking about all of these things, we need to really not look at it as a utopian dream, but really look at what are the implications for the families who are left in a community where right next to them is a very wealthy community who's able to put solar panels on their house and able to reduce their bills. And then the poorer communities surrounding them where they can't afford to do that are left with higher rates for the electricity that they need to be able to survive.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying, that we need programs that it doesn't even need to be a grant. A loan to a low-income family to put solar on a roof can then be paid back by that same family by the reduction in their electric bill. You know, that it's economically feasible. That they just need to have the upfront capital to get solar on the roofs. And then after that, their electric bill will be lower and they can afford to pay back the loan. And there are some solar companies who will put solar on the roof with no down payment because they know that the family will save the money to be able to pay them back. And we have some local solar companies that are willing to do that in low-income neighborhoods. But that's the point I'm trying to make, that this isn't something that is economically unreachable for low-income people. It's actually an economical way to power your house. Money.
Judy, I want to thank you for hanging in there with me on that tough line of questioning, because I think it's really, really important for us to bring that all out into the air, because these are a lot of the things that we hear people saying about these programs. And I want to make sure that we clarify all of these issues as we're moving forward in this discussion. So thank you for hanging in there with me on that.
Sure.
I would just like to chime in a little bit here is that what I really appreciate about this conversation and the arc that we're going on with it is that this is the conversation that this nation particularly has to have, is that we have an intersection of issues, including inequality, climate change, militarism, and we have a twisted, many-headed hydra, as Sherry said on two shows previously from this, of interconnected issues that make change challenging, tricky, requires us to be hyper creative in how we address them and to have these conversations. One of the aspects that I like to look at in inequality, and it's also an area that I work on in my movement building work, is how difficult it is to... There are no silver bullet solutions to the problems that we're facing. What we need is systemic solutions. And so what I appreciate about what you, Judy, and you, Sherry, are coming to together and articulating for the show and our listeners is the process of discovering what justice looks like in this complex field. One of the other areas that I know, the peace economy, the local economy, the local food movement, the climate justice movement, and the inequality movement are all working on together, is discussing how what we might call the haves in our society, or those who have the economic resources and hold the economic resources, can actually be a part of real substantial change, that if we're sitting on the resources of our society, as Judy said, we actually have a responsibility to initiate change, and also to really think and consider about how we make that an equitable change that we all can participate in, and the effects of those actions. But one of the areas I'd like to ask you about, Judy, is actually kind of an area that we don't see as obviously, and that is the area of divestment and reinvestment, investment and finance, and this kind of sort of shadow side of our economy that we don't necessarily see as clearly, but actually affects our lives quite deeply. What can you share with our listeners about the peace economy and that layer of shifts that are possible?
In terms of investing?
Yeah, in terms of investing or divesting and reinvesting.
Right.
Since you did mention that you do speak quite a bit with people who might have the capacity to do that, I think it would be very interesting to hear what are some of the options that are available to people who do have that capacity.
Right. I think the most important thing is taking divesting in the stock market, period, getting our money out of publicly traded companies, because that's just perpetuating a system that's based on profit, where the goals are all around money is valued more than life is, and that corporate goals are to maximize profits rather than to maximize well-being or happiness or any of the actual things that make life matter. So in disinvesting in the stock market, to me, the most important thing is to invest locally, to invest in our local entrepreneurs, and especially those that are building our local food system and our local renewable energy system and our local clothing system and so on, because it takes money to create an alternative economy to the one that is supporting a war economy and great inequality. So I like to say that when we invest locally, we not only get a financial reward, but a living return of living in a more fair, sustainable, and financially sustainable economy. And then there are more and more ways to do that, everything from putting money in local banks or local credit unions, local reinvestment funds of different sorts, to doing crowdsourcing and Kiva Zip, where you can invest as little as $25. And one of the projects that I'm doing right now addresses this, because I feel like there are a lot of people, especially my age, that are baby boomers who are retired and have excess money and also a great deal of experience and connections. And so I started something called the Circle of Aunts and Uncles. And the idea of this is to provide for the low-income entrepreneurs what upper-middle-class entrepreneurs get from their family, which is high-risk, early-stage microloans and mentoring, connections, guidance, support. So we have over 30 aunts and uncles who each put in $2,000 a year as a loan into a fund, and then we make loans of $1,000 to $12,000 to entrepreneurs at 3% interest. And the aunts and uncles don't collect any interest. That 3% goes in to maintain the fund. And so we're not doing it for even to make a return. It's really that I say the return, we're co-creating with the entrepreneurs, the investors and the entrepreneurs and our advisors are co-creating the community that we want to live in, you know, one that's more fair and just, sustainable, and so on. So we've only been doing it for a year, but it's based on relationships. It's based on building community between people that are experienced and those young entrepreneurs that are coming up and need a hand. The social capital is even more valuable than the money, because we connect young entrepreneurs with friends of ours that, like, you know, an example would be this young boutique owner, a Haitian American boutique owner, and we connected her with a woman who started a boutique in the 60s, and it's probably the most popular, oldest women's boutique in Philadelphia. And so now she's a mentor to the young person. So, you know, and then we also do support the store. You know, we tell our friends about it. We had a crowd shopping day there when she needed to sell off her winter goods to bring in her spring, and picked a certain day and had wine and cheese and spread the word. And we all showed up there to shop and connect and so on. So I'm just discovering now, like, all the different things that we can do and sort of developing this network of friends who want to help. A lawyer here, a real estate person there, a financial strategist, and so on. Some people put in the $2,000 and become an aunt or uncle. Other people just want to help in small ways because they're a lawyer and they'll do some pro bono work, or they're a real estate person will give some advice or whatever. So I'm so excited about how we're able to connect resources, both social capital and financial, to those that need that in a way that's personal and that's building community. And it's enjoyable. I really am enjoying working with these young entrepreneurs. And I can see my friends, some of them, they're like in their late 60s, early 70s, who want to be doing something, don't know what to do, that are now so excited about this work. And that's all about, you know, building our local economy. But that's just a small drop in the bucket that needs to be done. I mean, what we really need to do is to shift all of our savings out of the stock market and into financial vehicles like the RSF Social Finance in San Francisco. They have millions of dollars. It's not like the aunts and uncles. We've got 60,000. I mean, we need to shift large amounts of money into financial institutions that are directing it towards creating the world we want, towards sustainable agriculture and affordable housing and education and all these things that our communities need.
I think it's going to be really important going forward. We're going to truly talk about a peace economy, to really talk about the fact that, you know, there is a really big discrepancy here in the conversation that we're having and what I'm hearing and a broad view of what the problem is here. And I think that it's wonderful that people who have resources are trying to learn how to distribute those resources in a more humane way within their sphere of influence and are trying to work toward living more sustainably. But I also think that it's really important, I mean, just simple things, to note that some people don't have savings. And, you know, that needs to be part of the equation. That absolutely needs to be part of the equation. You can't be creating an economy of peace without consideration of how these things impact people that are living at the lowest levels of poverty within our country and in our communities. I don't want to belabor that for our whole discussion, but it's really got to be a key part of the work going forward. One of the things that I really want to hear about that I talked about in my last question is there are a number of laws that are coming forward right now. And I'm wondering if you've had any engagement with any groups that have been working to address these laws, where we are having state of Maine, you know, recently passed legislation, our governor, who may or may not be crazy, passed legislation that actually created huge obstacles for the use of solar power in the state of Maine. And there are things that are being done by industry that are actually blocking people, even well-intended people who are trying to do the right thing, who have the ability to do the right thing, from being able to engage that process. Have you run into that yet, or have you had any type of interaction with people that are addressing those issues?
No, but I've heard of these incidences, and they're all over the country. And, you know, because the oil and gas people are not going to go quietly away. They're pulling out all the stops to try and stop the clean energy movement. And I don't think it's going to be easy. Part of the problem is that conservative, it's not even just Democrats and Republicans, because the Democrats are also being swayed by oil and gas people. In Pennsylvania, we're a swing state, so we're about an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. And yet our legislature is totally blocked because the oil and gas industry in Pennsylvania is so powerful, and they invest, you know, millions of dollars into all the politicians' campaigns, or not all of them, but most of them, So they're totally controlled by them. And we have no tax on frack gas, whether any state in the country that doesn't. So I can't think of an example. Well, I'm sure there's many examples on a regular basis, like what the utility commission does, the decisions that they make. There's currently a law that makes it really difficult for solar companies to survive in Pennsylvania. And so there are people that are addressing that particular legislation, which has to do with, it's very complicated, and that's one of the tactics that they use to make things so complicated that people don't understand it. It's not a black and white situation. But it's a tax incentive system that makes it difficult for solar companies in Pennsylvania to survive. So a lot of them are getting business in neighboring New Jersey because of these laws. So unfortunately, I think that we're progressive people. We're really focusing on national elections, and the conservatives have been focusing so much on state elections, and a lot of the legislatures are now controlled by a right wing who tend to be climate deniers and are working directly, you know, for oil and gas people. So it's a huge issue. And I never paid much attention to what went on in our state capital, Harrisburg, myself. But now I realize, because of the energy crisis and the climate change crisis, how important it is to gain control of our local legislation, because that's where most of these unfair laws are being passed. And it's really behind the scenes. People don't understand it and so on. But I agree with you that there's obstacles now. I mean, my state of Pennsylvania was making great advances in solar 10 years ago, and now that's all gone. It's really hard industry in Philadelphia. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm trying to get more people to buy the solar, to keep our solar companies growing, because we need them. And they're providing green jobs locally as well. But anyway, yes, I agree with you. And I'm not directly a part of trying to change any particular law. I'm just trying to be a part of electing better local representatives that can counter these forces to a democratic process.
I think it's a great point about the upcoming elections. We forget in the circus of the presidential race that there are a number of state and federal congressional seats that are open that actually do make a number of policy shifts that can work for the benefit of people or for the detriment. And that's something everyone should keep in mind as we head towards November. You know, we're heading into the last few minutes of our show. The time goes by so quickly on Love and Revolution Radio, and there's so much more we could talk about, including some of the ways that we can kind of talk about the ways that we use peace economy, local economy, alternative economy within the framework of those who don't have a lot of financial resources. I know from my own experience growing up, and actually, Sherry, many of the stories you've told me about how you grew up, that we have more skills and resources than we think, and many of the solutions to our economic problems that are being proposed come out of that experience. Things such as tool co-ops, farming co-ops, trade, barter, and sharing network, bike co-ops. So that's a whole other level of discussion, and I want to remind our listeners, because we're running out of time, that we are speaking with Judy Wicks, who is the author of a great article on the peace economy on Alternet. She's also the author of a book called Good Morning, Beautiful Business. She's the founder of the White Dog Cafe in Philadelphia, and she's been a pioneer in sustainable and ethical businesses for a number of years. She's also the co-founder of the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. Judy, what are some tangible ways that listeners can go forth from this interview this week and actually engage with the peace economy, start making some choices and shifts towards it?
Well, I think it's almost in every aspect of our lives. I mean, just pick one thing, water. It's much better for the environment and the economy to drink water, tap water, that we can fill our reusable water bottles with rather than buying bottled water or bottled sodas or so on. That's just feeding these large corporations. I mean, Nestle owns a bottled water company, and those water companies are draining aquifers in rural communities where the people are suffering from that and don't have the power to stop them. And then they're putting it in plastic and shipping it long distance, which is bad for the environment, and then selling it, you know, where we could actually just use water from our tap water. We can make our teas and fill our canteen. So I think that getting a reusable water bottle and using local juices or making teas and using tap water in general, it's been shown that bottled water is less clean than tap water. that it's not regulated. The bottled water is not regulated and therefore can contain more bacteria and other things that come in water than tap water, which is highly regulated. So that's just a small thing, but just in general, to whenever we can, to support local or local farmers or local manufacturers or local coffee house owners, rather than going to a Starbucks to go to a local coffee house, whenever we can divert our money towards local entrepreneurs, we're empowering our own communities and not relying on a global system that's made possible by burning oil and employing the military.
Great. Well, thank you for those thoughts, Judy, and thank you for joining us on the show today.
Yes, thank you so much, Judy, for having this conversation with us, challenging as it was at times. I think that this is an important place for us all to meet in the midst of these challenging conversations and to be able to have them with one another humanely. So thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, you're welcome. And thanks for putting on your show. It sounds like a great show.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution. Love, love, love and revolution. Love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest Judy Wicks for engaging in the hard questions and digging deeper into the subjects. And thanks to my co-host Sherry Mitchell for being willing to take the conversation to the next level. Our theme song is Love and Revolution Radio, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
I'd also like to thank my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun, for her presence and for her accompaniment into this journey of examining our roles and our responsibilities within the society. And I'd like to thank Judy Wicks for hanging in there with us during some difficult questioning. If you enjoyed the things that I've shared on this show, you can also follow me on Facebook on my Sacred Instructions page, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. Many radio stations across the country have been picking up the show, and we would like to thank our many supporters who are helping to make that possible. You can have Love and Revolution Radio broadcast in your area by your local radio station if you simply ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Economic justice is an intersectional, challenging issue. It's complex. So maybe you'll take some time to examine and explore how you can engage with all these different new kinds of economies, the new economy, the local economy, the peace economy, and many more, in the ways that work for you, however you can, by the time we talk to you next week.